You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello and welcome to another damn fine cup of culture. Today, we are going to examine the stories Hollywood tells about itself. And we're going to do this by examining three films that are basically Hollywood stories that Hollywood made. And joining me for this project are Alan. Hello, Alan.
Hello.
And Sam.
Hi there, Julie.
And you each brought me a film. We are looking to see what Hollywood mythologizes about itself. Hollywood really likes to put its own legends on screen and its own stories on screen. And regardless of whether they're true or not, I wondered what our fascination is with Hollywood legend and mythology. So just to start off with very quickly, does anything spring to mind with you guys about Hollywood mythology? And if so, what?
Well, for me, it was always that I felt Hollywood films that were set in Hollywood always had this exaggerated sense of self-satire. There were always these mass scenes, you know, Great Gatsby style of massive parties, personalities, movie premieres, and there's always this sense of lots of things that you should know about the past of Hollywood put into these films. I'm thinking of Singing in the Rain as well, that I think we might talk about later on as well, where a lot of personalities were thrown into this maelstrom of energy, jazz music, crowds. And I think I was always fascinated by almost the catalog of scenes that these movies went through. And of course, for me as a movie fan on the one hand, it was fascinating, but I always felt a little over-challenged by these kinds of films that were telling a lot of different stories. I never quite knew what to make of them. And I think all three movies we're talking about today have those typical elements of those satire, yet how much of that is real. So I was really interested to go into the episode today.
And Alan?
Yeah, I mean, I think, as with a lot of people, it was very much like Hollywood Babylon got me into the sort of scurrilous side of Hollywood, because I'm old enough to remember the very tail end of the mythologized, the greats, in the sense that they were dying. And so someone famous would die in the early 80s and it would be on the news. And I remember it, and I'd sit there and go, I have no idea who that is at the time. You did, you know.
Right.
And so the news would be very much what an amazing person, what a great, what an immortal they were. And it was very much the legend that Hollywood had created for all these stars. And then you see something like Hollywood Babylon, which I remember reading and not really knowing anyone in it. But it still felt fun. It still felt that you were the official line that still was being told in these obituaries suddenly had this sort of darker side, the sort of darker underbelly, which was really sort of fascinating to sort of peek behind the curtain a little bit. And I remember that, you know, and then of course you discover that, you know, Hollywood Babylon is itself mostly a fiction. And so the telling of the scurrilous side is its own mythology, that you have the stuff that the studio sold that is the sort of very positive mythology. And then you have an industry that is the scurrilous, the lies, but the lies that people want for the gossip. And I thought that was really Hollywood Babylon, reading that, not knowing who anyone was, which sort of prompted me to research into them, was sort of a sort of gateway into a lot of classic Hollywood, a lot of these two completely different but sort of enmeshed myths of the glorious and the scurrilous.
Mm-hmm. That book is, it won't surprise you to hear me say this, but that book is a pack of lies, people. That is a pack of lies. They are very lurid lies and in their way very fascinating, but they are mostly untrue and at the most charitable, speculative.
But they make for fascinating films. And apparently over the years, there seems to be that kind of film popping up again and again. So it seems like a remake of those lurid pack of lies, right? In one form or the other. So that's what I found fascinating.
It's as if we've adopted them rather than looking at what actually was true. We sort of adopted them and kept them close to our hearts and really think that Bugsy Siegel was like in the film Bugsy, as portrayed by Warren Beatty, which he was not. And we don't know why the flamingo was called the flamingo, right? They have all these theories, some of them straight from Hollywood Babylon, sometimes from the sort of I don't know, speculation mill that is Hollywood, and we sort of take them for gospel, while they may not be accurate, you know? And nobody cares, really. All right, let's dive in, shall we? Sam, we've done this in chronological order for today, and you have our first film, The Day of the Locust, with a title like that. I'm guessing it's not a very cheerful film. Why don't you tell us about it?
It isn't. Well, I think fascinatingly, at the beginning, you don't quite know. We have a set of characters coming to Hollywood from different angles. Production designer Todd, played by William Atherton, comes in. He moves into an apartment complex where he meets a set of other characters, among others, Faye, played by Karen Black, and her salesman father, Harry, played by Burgess Meredith. And these characters then start to somehow meet and meet again, either at the apartment, at the studio. She tries to become an actress. She's an extra on a couple of films that he starts to slowly get his foot into production designing. So you see, I think the general outset at the beginning could show them either be successful or not. But I think the film from the very beginning has these signs of something is not quite right. Everything looks a bit too nostalgic, a bit too unreal at times. The whole film is like tainted in yellow a little bit. These glorious images of Hollywood and Hollywood villas. And sooner or later, there's also things happening in the background that show the corruption of Hollywood, the lack of investment in proper production values, for instance, for a studio set, or some weird characters showing up all through the film, a little boy cheekily teasing everybody. And then later on, also a character called Homer Simpson, which, of course, no one quite remembers that this is the origin of that very famous name. Played by Donald Sutherland here, and basically
who's great in this,
fantastic,
he's fabulous,
and he's scary as well at the same time. So this film starts to tilt into the absurd and into the more and more. I think there's like a pull into the where you feel something is not going to go well in this case. Those characters are not going to succeed. And I think it builds up then to one of the most horrifying finales that I've ever seen in a film until this day, which then I think corresponds to the title, Day of the Locust. There's some kind of biblical proportion catastrophe that happens at the end. And that's based on a novel by Nathaniel West that I haven't read, but I'd be curious to see how faithful the film is to the novel. To me, it felt a little bit like the adaptation of a novel rather than a properly built-up film, but that's maybe just my take. What did you think of that first example, Day of the Locust?
It's grim. It's properly grim. there are a couple of nice, I think, touches in it as to the complete disregard to health and safety of the studios,
mm-hmm.
right? Which we know from anecdotes is probably true. I mean, they really did not care if people fell down, you know, meters and meters because the stage was built properly. So there's that. Then there's the female who is so vile is that it's you almost do not believe her. And I know this is supposed to be satire, but it becomes difficult to follow the infatuation our protagonist has with her, even though he knows what type of person she is. He seems to just not care. Her beauty is all that there is and ever will be, but she is absolutely vile. And then, of course, well, the ending, I mean, the novel, I think, was written close to the 30s and 40s, in which this, which is this, the setting of the film, right? And the film was only made in, what is it, 75?
75, yeah.
So there seems to be a sort of distance between when the film was made and when the book was actually written, much closer. And I think much more steeped in fascism is coming. There is a huge economic crisis. I mean, we tend to forget nowadays how bad the 30s were in America. And the Hoovervilles and the injustice and, you know, eye-watering unemployment. And it was just dreadful. And that sort of sense of dread becomes, as you say, it becomes a sort of biblical epic in which, you know, this community is beset by almost supernatural events falling on them. I think it's interesting, but I think it's an extremely grim way of looking at the community during that time. I don't know, Alan, what did you think?
I definitely agree there's a grimness to it. And I think a comment that I did notice when I was researching it was, you're almost horror-like. There's a horror element to this. Because I'd not seen this before. So that watching it for this podcast was the first time that I'd watched the film. And so you sort of go in, I try not to do any research because I didn't really know much about the film. And I thought I'll go in and just experience it. So I didn't know which way would, I knew it would be slightly satirical. So I was expecting something along those lines, slightly darkly satirical. And the extent to which it is grim, horrific is really quite astounding. And I think the other thing which really struck me that I think makes it unique in films about Hollywood that Hollywood has made is it feels bitter. It feels like it's made by people who do not like Hollywood and have become embittered by Hollywood. There is no, and I think this is probably a weakness in the film, there is no glimpse as to why Hollywood is liked, why people would want to break into Hollywood, why this place has, you know, for the 20th century, it kind of captured the world imagination. There's nothing to suggest why that happened. And we're left with like these awful people who are quite two-dimensionally awful people. They don't have any inner life that might point us to why they're awful. They seem to exist to tell us Hollywood is full of awful people. It's a horrible place. And I just found this sort of quite interesting that it feels like, and I was trying to place it in time. This is 1975. So very, very much the golden age is dead and you're moving. You're in the sort of almost the heyday of the sort of 70s. Sort of boom of sort of independence. But I imagine that some of the people working on this remember the golden age and actually have no illusions about the romance about it. They just remember it as being terrible. And it was an industry and it treated people poorly. And this feels like a film that they would make because this is a film that has no room for that. No room at all. And I was really surprised by that because I can't think of another Hollywood, even films that fancy themselves as being quite dark about Hollywood. Stuff like The Player, still, I think, goes quite soft and plays with the romance of it, or at least accepts people want to do this. People want to engage with Hollywood. And this has none of that. This is like, it is a horrible place. Look at it. Look at all this horrible stuff. And then sit and watch like this long period of hideousness that ends terribly. It's quite a surprising, unique film in that regard.
It's also relentless. It does not allow one tiny ray of sunshine. I mean, at the beginning, you think the father may be a sympathetic character, but he turns out to be a complete prick. And there is just no, the film will not allow you to sentimentalize even one bit of it or to see one little ray of hope. It's just a disgusting pile.
But it, you know, it's why I love the 70s so much for that. The 70s could do that in Hollywood after the 60s were done and the studio system was done and you finally were able to make a film like that on Hollywood and by Paramount. I was so surprised to see, you know, made by Paramount on the Paramount lot. It feels very authentically LA and all the locations, including the Hollywood Hills. And it's really, I mean, it's set in that supposedly glorious yellowish light at the beginning, at least you feel this is going to be a nostalgic ride. But then of course, it being a 70s movie, Schlesinger doing it somewhere between Midnight Cowboy and Marathon Man. So that's definitely not going to be a nostalgic, lovely piece on the glory days of Hollywood. But I do enjoy the grittiness of it somewhat because I felt, yes, they were able to finally make that movie and tell it. Maybe not the way it was, but tell the ugly side. The collapsed studio set, the people tearing each other literally apart at the end. It seemed like, you know, a metaphor for all the things that maybe had piled up underneath in the underbelly that you were never able to be shown. And now it's out front and culminates in that. Still think one of the most disturbing endings to a movie I've seen, and I watched it a second or third time now. I still was horrified by it.
And it comes out of nowhere. Yes. It just kicks you in the gut out of nowhere. You're like, where is this going, right? And then suddenly you get this horrifying sort of violence out of absolutely nothing. And of course, with some context, you understand that, okay, this is the 30s, fascism is on the rise. Dog eats dog. But even so, and I watched it, I think, the third time, and I was still almost taken aback by how quickly it all goes very, very, very badly wrong.
Very badly wrong. But yes, some of my favorite 70s actors as well in bigger or smaller roles. I mean, Karen Black really, you know, that's one of her biggest roles that she ever had. And I feel she's perfect for that, you know, in a way. She's this ditzy, power or success hungry actress. She's still vulnerable to a certain degree about her father and his demise. And Donald Sutherland is great. We've already mentioned that. Geraldine Page is in that as well, as this crazy religious person going through those healing procedures.
Oh, she must have had such fun with that scene.
She's just so incredible, underused. But she's one of my favorite people from 70s, 80s movies. So I love just the casting, the production values, obviously the source music use and the John Barry score. It just, you know, it brings all the things together that I like, but to horrible effect, almost unbearable effect about Hollywood.
I mean, what I would say, I think to some extent, is probably its fatal flaw for me. And I think this is probably watching it in 2023 and not 1975, is it's sort of saying we are exposing the cruel underbelly of Hollywood at this time. But there's no surprises in it. Even if you like Golden Age Hollywood, I think people who, like me, who watch it, knows that people weren't given a fair break, know that roles were given unfairly, that people were, extras were treated badly. It's telling me a system that I knew it worked like. And so there was sort of a weird lack of surprises. And I think, and this is probably going back personally, what has been interesting in the time since first reading Hollywood Babylon and just to now is the level to which the dark underbelly of Hollywood treated women and minorities so badly, so shockingly badly.
Mm-hmm.
That's not really in this film. And that, I think, is... I think the thing that Hollywood, the first thing it was able to say about itself is, oh, we were a bit too capitalist. We were a bit too soul crushing on people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But this film seems to sort of turn it around and go, but you know what? The people were awful too. It's like there's no redeeming feature to anyone's. It's sort of like this is a horrible system, but it's being horrible to horrible people. And I think the sort of main female character probably is something that hasn't dated so well. Because I think it's basically saying she is awful. She is promiscuous and that is awful. She has this absolutely narcissistic, almost sociopathic desire to be famous. That is awful. And there's nothing on why she is doing that. Why she would be making those choices. It is just, look at this horrible person. And I think, again, this is slightly unfairly looking at it with 2023 eyes, but... Yeah, I don't think you can let the Hollywood system off the hook like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think the sort of treatment, it is sort of the darkest part of Hollywood in a way that maybe, you know, yeah, there wasn't great workers' rights, but if you went in construction, people would have been dying all the time because there were no workers' rights. That very much is how Hollywood operates, but how much America operates. But what's interesting about Hollywood is you have this strange world of power play where it was an industry that more than any other was encouraging women to join, would have people from very different backgrounds in it. And then almost over time became worse and worse for these people. If you look at the very early Hollywood, how powerful women were, how mixed it was, and then that industry changed. It didn't happen organically. It was white men took over and they created this system. And I think watching Day of the Locust, and especially how it treats the characters who are almost the victim, and it kind of makes them feel, you're guilty of this. This system is horrible because these people are horrible. And I think that felt, I mean, I enjoyed reveling in its ghastliness, but as a horror film, I think it has so, but I think once you sort of start thinking about it as a commentary on Hollywood, it's actually a surprisingly shallow commentary, I think.
Well, it's a disservice, I think, to history. A part of it is that it's set in the 30s, not earlier. I think the period that you allude to, Alan, is the teens and the 20s mainly, where there were a lot of sort of bohemians and outsiders and misfits populating and being successful in this industry. And when the big money took over, you get a more traditional patriarchal influence in that. And this is the 30s again, where there was a tendency towards the more puritanical, even though life at the time... had still, you know, remnants of the 20s and the roaring 20s and the really unbelievable promiscuity and hedonism that brought. But also, as you say, the film forgets swaths of people who we keep forgetting who are in Hollywood too. People of color, people of all sorts of shapes and sizes, they are omitted, not just from this film, but from history, which is, I think, it's a missed opportunity. And the way that women were used at the time, and the way that vulnerable women in particular were catapulted Marilyn Monroe-like to sex symbol status, and then expected to be lovely homebodies who still baked pancakes for their husbands at breakfast, is of course absurd. So you don't get that context either. In our female protagonist, it's about what it takes to be a woman in Hollywood at that time. And the shattering hypocrisy of that context. I mean, in that sense, I agree with you, Alan. It's that would have fitted in there rather well. But I don't think it's in the book.
Yeah, it feels like a very 70s take, in the sense that the 70s film industry, that was still its blind spots. It's still, this is the next generation of white men making a film about how terrible the last lot were, but they're blind to their own attitudes towards women, attitude, you know, that I think is sort of quite an interesting angle on it. And something else I noticed, which I think the fact they used the name Homer Simpson reminded me of, is I think it's when the Simpsons satirize Scorsese's The Departed. And they have the rat crossing at the back of a scene. And one of the voices goes, you know, the rat stands for obviousness. And it's this sort of, you know, sometimes satirical imagery, it's so in your face that you just go, oh, you're telling me this is bad. Like it almost crosses the line into being a lecture. And I think it works in this film at points, and at other points in this film, it feels like a lecture. And, you know, we're just hamming home the point is everything is awful in the most obvious visual way. But other times, like I said, its bleakness is unique. I've not seen something tackle this so head on. And that, I think, is what makes it worth a visit to have a look at it. Because when it works, and some of the scenes, I think the scene where they sort of gather to watch a sort of early pornographic film, stuff like that feels really interesting. It really is showing you something that I'd not seen before. And putting it in a context of, well, this is all horrible, isn't it? That I think it probably, you know, it needs to go into.
It has a great deal of fun with the porn.
Yeah.
It's the best, probably the best thing in it. Yeah.
But maybe having, you know, that sense of exaggeration with the ending that we already mentioned does it also a disservice, because I don't think we perceive that as in any way realistic to what happened in Hollywood back then. We know by this point it's been so heavily over satirized and exaggerated that I don't think we go away from the movie to think, well, that's how Hollywood was back in the day. It's rarely the case, right? It's more like a fable almost. And it's also treated that way as musically and in terms of the unrealism of the imagery. I think it often feels like, oh, this is like just not a comic book, that would be too funny. But it's like
surreal,
cartoonish,
right?
Surreal. So I don't even know if it was perceived to be that's the way Hollywood was like.
No. But it still directly satirizes Hollywood culture and community. So, of course, we're all aware that this is satire. And, of course, we're all aware that it's surrealism in a real way. But it by what it omits, right, it tells you something about how you're supposed to perceive Hollywood. Do you see what I mean? It doesn't pretend to be history, but by omission, it tells us something about a Hollywood that never was, that it doesn't intend to specify, a Hollywood that is white, a Hollywood that is a certain kind of people, a certain kind of nepotism. Our protag gets his first job because one of the studio execs was at Harvard as well, and he uses this to wheedle himself into a job, for instance, that sort of type of nepotism. Mm-hmm. But again, it sort of omits... It omits some of the injustices that actually were there. And by doing that, it gives us an image of a Hollywood that I think is skewed towards white maleness, is what I'm trying to say. I'm sorry about the highfalutin commentary.
No, for sure. And also think a movie produced by a big studio. We said, again, this is a Paramount movie in the 1970s. So I guess also the people deciding on what was made and how it was made and how it was supposed to be released played a big role in this, that was not meant to be a full-scale, realistic picture on Hollywood of the time.
No.
I like the word you used, fable, in terms of it. I think that's a good way of sort of capturing what the film is, the tone it's going for, and how to sort of engage with its surreal elements and its sort of over-the-top elements. It has a really nice feeling of the sort of uncanny and the unsettling. which I sort of, you know, that's really enjoyable. And I think you can probably, I think David Lynch has seen this film. I think there are moments where it's more interested in that unsettling tone than making sense.
Yeah, of course,
or really being super coherent. And that is a sort of a point in its favor. And I think, yeah, if you put that in the context of a fable, you're not watching history. You're watching this moralistic tale. It makes sense of it. It's just, to some extent, the morality behind the moralistic tale is very simple. It is like awful people being awful to each other. That's a bad thing. And I kind of knew that, so it's not any revelation. But yeah, no, I think there's a lot to recommend in this film.
There is, yeah. Speaking of white maleness, I think that's a bridge to our next film. I brought The Aviator by Martin Scorsese. And it's basically a straight biopic of Howard Hughes. But to start off, I think in the current age, we've forgotten what kind of a myth and a mystery Howard Hughes was at the time. And watching a film that tries to demystify this man requires that we are aware of the myth. And Marty himself would have known about it, but we don't necessarily. So I did a little search about Howard Hughes. This is from Slouching Towards Bethlehem by Joan Didion. And I simply looked for the term Howard Hughes. And here it says, Howard Hughes commandeers the fifth floor of the Boston Ritz. Howard Hughes is or is not buying 37.5% of Columbia Pictures through the Swiss bank de Paris. Howard Hughes is en route to Boston aboard the Super Chief with a Bel Air patrol riding shotgun. And then you get Howard Hughes is dead. Howard Hughes is in Las Vegas. Howard Hughes is everywhere. And every single mystery in Hollywood has Howard Hughes behind it. I think there was an apocryphal story that he was going to buy Pepsi Cola. There was so much nonsense about him because he was a recluse by this time. He had shut himself up in his hotel, refused to see anyone. And so, of course, stories and speculation were rife. Where is Howard Hughes? How is Howard Hughes doing? Is he dead? And Marty now makes a very straight, chronological biopic about the man, Howard Hughes. And tries to put in as much fact as he can think of. It's a very, very long film, almost 3 hours. And I absolutely adore it because even though Howard Hughes was even a bigger of a rotter than he's portrayed here, and he is portrayed quite unsentimentally, I think, for Marty's way of doing things, he was even a worse rotter in real life. But at least the film doesn't shirk the fact that that man was a nasty, nasty control freak, misogynist, howlingly racist person with severe mental issues and lots of bumps to the head. If this sounds appetizing to you, not many people love this film as much as I do. So let me start. Sam, I have been, you know, sitting on my hands. I knew you were going to watch this. I knew you hated it before. I want to know how you feel about it now with my heartfelt endorsement of it.
Well, first, maybe I have to go back to why I hated it so much at the time when it came out. I saw it when it was out fresh. And of course, we were big Leo DiCaprio fans at the time. Titanic, Romeo and Juliet. He was our romantic hero. And this film was probably one of the earlier opportunities for him to have such a major role and be properly questionable, nasty, and go into phases of complete lunacy in the course of the film. And to my memory, and also watching again, I thought the most I remember about the film was him going loopier and crazier and more obsessive compulsive as the film drags on, famously with that scene where he locks himself in that theater in for weeks on end. And I thought the film just remained in this scene and these kinds of scenes increasingly much. And I was just annoyed and bored by the film at the time. Even though I enjoy, you know, obviously Cate Blanchett as Katharine Hepburn, I enjoyed the acting. I thought some of the aviation scenes were fantastic at the time as well. But I walked away from the film completely annoyed by how much time was spent in a very long film on the disintegration of his mind. And Leo, somehow I felt at the time, hamming it up. I wasn't convinced by his portrayal at the time. And also, I don't think I took a lot of interest into researching who Howard Hughes was. The film just was off-putting to me. And I saved it in my mind as this awful film that I never wanted to watch again. And then up came our podcast. And I rewatched it again. I made an effort. And I thought it was magnificent.
Oh, good.
I had a complete, like, change of heart. I didn't mind the DiCaprio performance as much anymore. I thought it was very consistent and well built up from beginning to end. I liked the build up of the obsessive compulsion in the film now, how subtle it is at the beginning and then how excessive it becomes. And obviously I had many more, I think, connection points to characters that show up from the film industry. And also, obviously, his involvement, the Senate hearings, the TWA story. I thought it was so interesting to watch. And just having come off Killers of the Flower Moon and having talked about it with Matt in our other podcast, it was interesting to see another Scorsese movie back to back, pretty much, and to see how meticulous he was about showing this Howard Hughes story step by step. So I was marveling at this movie also in terms of production values. So completely rectified.
You did a 180.
Yes.
Also the loop in the air. That's probably a more appropriate way of describing
it. Yeah. Loop de loop. It's probably worth mentioning, just as an aside, is that I usually get very annoyed by the portrayal of mental issues in films. And DiCaprio, as you say, overdoes it a little bit. But they trained to portray his OCD as best they could. And I do appreciate that they put in the work to not go to a complete platitude about, you know, people with OCD and different mental issues as well. I mean, he got a lot of head trauma in his life and that can't have helped. And the paranoia, right? And I think you mentioned the scene in the screening room that is very famous. But one of the most horrifying scenes, I think, is when he starts repeating the same sentence over and over.
Oh, yeah.
And he realizes there is something not right and he can't put his finger on what it is, and people around him are trying to protect him. And this is when he realizes there is something deeply wrong. And I always thought that was probably the more affecting of the mental illness scenes. But anyway, down to you, Al. Did you hate the film before? Do you love it now? Do you hate it even more now?
I mean, I think the term I would use, and you used it in the introduction, that really I think fits this film almost to a T, is that it's a straight biopic, in the sense that it is the biopic that Hollywood would make when they say, this person has got a great story, let's just show it. So there's a lot to this film, but it is a visual recreation of his life, in a way.
Yeah.
It isn't an attempt to understand him, which I think would have to come with, you have to make assumptions. If you tell a biopic that tries to get inside the character, you have to sort of make quite imaginative leaps to think, well, I think this is probably why. And it avoids pretty much all of that, to just say he had this interesting life and these are the events that happened to him. And I think as a biopic, I find that interesting, because he has an interesting life and it is an interesting period. And, you know, you have Cate Blanchett turning up and it's a very good impression. You feel that captures Hepburn, but that's all it is. Mm-hmm. And she sort of turns up, ticks a box, and then we move on to another event in his life. And I think it is something, and because it's Scorsese, its visual storytelling is great. There's an element to which, like, one of his sort of skills as a director is that you could almost turn something of his on, and it's not even one of his best films, and I think the visual storytelling just draws you in, you get hooked, and you get carried along, and the next thing you know is like, well, has an hour just passed? I didn't realize it. He has that quality. But I think there is, and why it's sort of fittingly a Hollywood biopic, it is that style, it is that sheen, it is that incredible visual storytelling, but it's not scratching under the surface too much. If I could almost put it this way, yeah, Howard Hughes was a rotter, but this is the Hollywoodization of his rotterness. Like, we'll include it, but it is a box that's ticked. We'll make sure it's covered in this film. Whereas I think, and this is probably personal, a biopic I would be more interested in seeing, and I appreciate it's not fair to judge a film in these terms, is, I mean, how much of that horribleness inspired a lot of his greatness? Or to get to the heart of what possibly made this person tick is, I think, where biopics sort of can be really interesting. And he's a character to which there's a lot of mileage in that, even though they'll never be the answer. But this film sort of skirts all of that to say, he had an amazing life. We have all these incredible incidents. Let's show them. And so it strings them together in this like long film, because it's a long life. But it's Hollywood. This is an amazing story. Print the legend, show the story. I don't think coming out, you really have much of an insight on Howard Hughes beyond what you could have got from a sentence summary or a paragraph summary of this sort of, he was complicated, he was rich, he went mad, and he treated people badly. At the end of the film, you've not really got much more than that.
Yeah.
You've just had this 3-hour fun journey as it's been shown to you.
Well, three things about that. The first is that a dead giveaway is that what Marty does visually is he recreates certain filming techniques of the time. So 2-strip, 3-strip Technicolor. This is a hint that he's really not that interested in crawling into Howard Hughes's head. He's interested in the way they made movies at the time, technically, but also all the people. I mean, this movie should have been called Howard Hughes's Women, basically, and not The Aviator. But then he tries at the very beginning to give a hint about what he thinks makes Howard Hughes tick. Howard Hughes was very coddled as a boy. His mother was very controlling. This is all true. And very interested in his hygiene. This is not on the film, but she apparently checked his feces every night. There was a sort of almost controlling coddling. And then, of course, she died and his dad died. And he fought really hard as a minor to get his entire inheritance. He went to court because otherwise he would have had to wait 3 years and be under their control. So from a very early age, he was at it by himself. And this creature who had always been coddled and been made to believe that he was really, really something special is now at it alone and sort of believes that he can do it all alone, Musk-like, that he is this genius who is right when everybody else is wrong. And I think Marty gives us a hint of that in the very first scene, then lets it go and never goes back to it at all about this sort of trauma of his youth. And then thirdly, so much of this movie is true. So the cleavage measuring happened. The waiting for the perfect cloud, that happened. What also happened is that when Howard Hughes was working with Jane Russell, he designed her a bra because he thought her breasts were not looking good enough on screen. According to Russell, the bra was an atrocity and she ended up just wearing her own and padding it a little bit and made him believe that it was his design when it never was. He was also very much obsessed with Jane Russell's assets. So much of this absurd story is quite true. And you almost have to check yourself. Like, this can't possibly... I mean, Hollywood was weird at that time. It was not that weird. Yes, people, it was that weird. And I sort of appreciate Marty putting in that much work to go like, I want to put these things in because and adhere as closely to the truth as possible because the truth is so much stranger than fiction.
And you know what I thought, just comparing the three movies that we have today and going back to what I said at the beginning about exaggeration and these almost cliché scenes that we have in these movies on Hollywood, with Scorsese, I felt he really knows what he's doing all along the way. He knows the techniques. He really recreates them. He stages these party scenes with the jazz band and everyone mingling there. And it feels, yeah, that's the way it must have been. Whereas with the other films, and we'll talk without spoiling anything, but I felt they sometimes don't know what they're doing. They're either doing something else or they're just uninformed about certain things. They didn't know the feel of that. With The Aviator, I felt, yeah, we're really moving through Hollywood as it was, even though it feels like unbelievable stuff. But then knowing that this is real makes absolute sense because it felt this is Hollywood as it was. And I think that's basically what we want from a movie on Hollywood, right? We want to have some sense that this is not just a fabulation, but some of that is happening in a context that was at least to a certain extent like that.
Yeah, and significantly, and that contrasted with Day of the Locust, Marty loves old Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he knows how bad it is, but he can't help himself. He thinks it's so grand with the Hell's Angels and the big parties and Errol Flynn getting into a fight at a nightclub and, you know, Ava Gardner throwing a bronze bust at Howard Hughes. He loves that sort of stuff, I think, almost despite himself. And I think that's what sets it apart, or what does for me, at least.
And I think, you know, there is, like you said, there's the myth of Hollywood, but there are true stories about Hollywood that are incredible. I think that helps feed the myth, because then other outlandish stories, they might be true, because something else we heard turns out to definitely be true. And I think, you know, that helps the Hollywood machine, that it wasn't a very dull place that now people have had to invent amazing things. Amazing things did happen. So when someone tells you a new amazing thing that actually isn't true, it's like, oh, yeah, that sounds like it could have happened. And I think this sort of shows that, like, yeah, even taking out the nonsense there are sort of incredible stories here. But I mean, the one thing I would also say a little bit, which I think is maybe repeating myself a little bit of Day of the Locust, there is this Hollywood, you know, we talked that it does downplay his rottenness. But I mean, in 30 years' time, do we want the Harvey Weinstein film to kind of mention at the end he was a bit of a rotter? You know, if they made a biopic, would that be, oh, but he did these amazing things early on about introducing America to art house cinema. He came from nowhere. He did all this. It's a fascinating story. Oh, he was a bit of a rotter. You know, it can't quite let go of Howard Hughes as not heroic, but the mythology is centered on him. And
as a tragic figure. Yeah.
And again, I kind of feel that if he emerged now, we would not make this film. We would not tell the mythology in this way, because what we know now about his behavior in terms of controlling, in terms of being abusive, in terms of the sort of Hollywood casting couch, it is on Weinstein levels. I mean, he was a character that operated like that, as well as romancing famous stars, which is, of course, the bit Hollywood is more comfortable with. They're much more comfortable with Katharine Hepburn, the story of him with Katharine Hepburn, rather than all the no-name people that he basically kept in flats in Hollywood that weren't allowed to go out, that he would keep for years, promising them success. Mm. And then they were just there that he could sleep with them when they wanted to, or even it ended up his henchmen would sleep with them. And it was almost an industrial, you know, it has this industrial quality of this is what he created.
That's scary.
And so you look at, you know, what was the revelations about Weinstein or this sort of abuse in Hollywood now. And, you know, we wouldn't say, ah, they were characters, so let's make the biopic and we'll cover it. We'll mention it, but we'll also mention the really interesting stuff.
Oh, we do that all the time with Chaplin, right? It's that he's lionized as this comedic genius, which he was. He also liked very, very, very young girls.
Yeah.
Who he really liked to control, belittle, and talk down to. So in fairness to Marty, we kind of do that all the time.
And I think we do that all the time. Hollywood does that all the time. I think Hollywood is very good at selling this side. That Hollywood actually, and you can be a bit cynical about it, it will admit terrible stuff has happened, but it successfully slots that into the myth about itself. And actually, it makes a lot of the terrible stuff sound a little bit exciting. Mm-hmm. You know, and it weaves it into the narrative. So, like, they had so much money, they ended up behaving badly. Don't you want to see that story?
Right.
And it is sort of how it's transitioned from sort of golden age, everyone's moral and perfect, to sort of like, it was a fantastic party. Both miss the point.
True.
And I think you wouldn't allow that now with a figure now to then go, let's make an aviator star biopic. And I think it's interesting that by telling the story this way, we are showing how we still engage with Hollywood mythology. And I mean, I'm as guilty as the next person. Howard Hughes' story is fascinating. It is really interesting. But I think the Hollywood film tells it, takes this approach of, we're just going to do all the interesting things, mention the bad stuff, and then that's your picture, that's your full picture. And you just raise the question, we wouldn't accept that if they made a Harvey Weinstein biopic.
Well, my criticism, I think, to agree with you a little bit, is that at the end, with the scene in the screening room where he's gone to pieces, he again has to be redeemed specifically by these women. And this is necessary, because otherwise we are just not going to stick with this person. So we need Katharine Hepburn, we need Ava Gardner, we need these fabulous, successful women to love him so that we can see that there is something redeemable. Of course, there's something redeemable about every human being, even historical human beings. But it's interesting that the film needs that scene.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole discussion is fascinating in the context that this is a movie produced by Harvey Weinstein, right?
Mm.
I mean, this is a Miramax picture produced by the Weinsteins. So, I mean, I wonder, you know, what the context of that means, looking at how Howard Hughes is portrayed here and how the Hollywood system is produced here and why such a movie functions, knowing that at the same time, a completely perverted system of exploitation was going on as well. That was, you know, how would such a film be made today if The Aviator was produced today? How would that be different? But maybe that's a discussion to be held about our third film as well, right? Because, I mean, that was came just out last year. So how does that treat Hollywood myth and scandal?
And could it have been made now?
Yeah, could could Babylon be made in 2023? This 2022 film. Yeah, no, so that's the film I sort of brought along when we were talking about the subject. And to be honest, I hadn't seen it when I suggested it. But it was a film that came out last year and I really wanted to see and just couldn't get around to seeing it. I didn't last long in the cinemas. It wasn't a box office success. And I was on the list of, so I do want to see this. It feels like it's classic Hollywood. It's in my wheelhouse. I want to see this. So it was a perfect excuse to actually suggest it. And then, you know, not knowing whether I would be here sort of triumphing my selection or defending it or apologizing because I had no idea what to expect. But I think, you know, it is a very modern take on the sort of classic era of Hollywood and in particular transition from silent film to sound. So that's sort of the era we are. It's an era of an industry learning making films and stars learning how to be stars. In the context of a place that suddenly got very rich and doesn't really feel like the rules apply. So you have a sort of sense of the sort of chaos of Hollywood and also how that chaos struggled to deal with change, struggled to deal with certain characters, I think. So it's very much a sort of story that sort of focuses on two characters in particular. And you sort of follow them in their story. One is a guy originally from Mexico who is sort of working behind the scenes, who gets jobs helping out on the productions and becomes quite a sort of fixer behind the scenes. And the other is a starlet, someone who becomes famous. What really struck me watching it now is I didn't get a feeling of the transition to sound. It almost didn't feel like it felt like a commentary on now. It felt like a film talking about how Hollywood is now, in a sense that there's a universal element to it. And there's a side to its over-the-top nature that didn't feel like it fitted how I sort of think Hollywood was. I mean, I think the golden age of Hollywood, it was debauched, but I don't think it was the party at the beginning debauched. I think it was a lot of money, but I don't think you would have had much more than what students now get drunk and have a slightly debauched party. I don't think they shattered the boundaries. I don't think that it was a place where, by the standards of the time, it was decadent, but it wasn't that level of party decadent. That felt quite modern. And I thought it was quite interesting that to be telling this, and I think the level of diversity, I think, feels quite deliberately modern, in a sense that you wouldn't have had that diversity in the same way at the time. So sometimes it felt to me like the satire is, things haven't changed as much as we'd hoped. This is still a place that is terrible. There is still this place where people can be destroyed. There is still the place where drugs destroy people. But it felt like it felt to me, this is my sort of interpretation, that it was kind of modern. And the other thing that really struck me, and I think the two films would make the perfect double bill, is it is the anti-Day of the Locust. Where I think the Day of the Locust is a bitter film that has no time for romanticization. This is such a romantic film about the period. Even to the extent that I think it's saying, weren't the parties great? Wasn't the drug taking fun? It looks glamorous. And I think it very much buys into the romance of it. And I don't think there is an interesting play, not going to spoil too much, with Singing in the Rain in this. I mean, it's sort of referenced at the end, but there's nods to it. There's almost Easter eggs throughout the film that scenes are done up to look like Singing in the Rain, or characters look like a character in Singing. It has this nod to it. And I think at its heart, it is a Singing in the Rain. It is romantically entranced by cinema. In the same way I think that feels that. And ultimately, I think it can't quite shake that off. Whereas The Day of the Locust would laugh derisively if it was a film that ever got to watch Singing in the Rain. And it would like point out how much of a bastard Gene Kelly could be. And it would mention the horrible story. No, there's no joy in this would be Day of the Locust. I think Babylon would view it and go, ah. And the final shot of the scene, smiling at Singing in the Rain. That is, this film is, it's showing the awfulness, but within a, wasn't it amazing in the big scale of things? And it produced an industry that made all this amazing stuff. Maybe that's all worth it. It's an incredibly romantic film. Whereas The Aviator is quite dry. Like you said, it's being realistic. It's telling what happened. And The Day of the Locust is like, hates Hollywood and wants you to know. This is like the anti-Day of the Locust. This is a very romantic film about the dark side of Hollywood.
That is so interesting.
Mm.
Because I had quite a different take on this. To me, Babylon felt like if you got the most lurid tabloids of the 30s, put them in a big pile. You know, I forget the names of the magazines, but they were almost, you know, pornographic tabloids. All of it was untrue and they tricked people into making recordings that were really, really terrible. So you put all those into a big pile, make a script out of it, film it with the best all-star cast and the most beautiful production film values that you can find, and that would be Babylon. It reads to me like a 1930s tabloid. Rather than it tries to sort of wriggle in social media culture and horror films at the very end there in the, I don't know, the catacombs where they end up. But I'm like, it just sounds like you're filming some sort of 30s tabloid with modern stars. So I had a very different reaction to it.
But isn't there something exciting and enthralling about that lurid tabloid? You know, we don't accept the golden age moral view of things anymore. The fun is the tabloids in the back burner, and the story behind the tabloids is fun. And I think people like that. I think the maker of this film likes that. I think he's showing this because its luridness is quite exciting.
But then why use historical personages, or to be more precise, mashups of historical personages? I mean, the protagonist, Nelly, is basically Clara Bow. She's Clara Bow. Come on. It's a dead giveaway. Why then use Clara Bow and then skew her story to fit your own? I mean, it's just, I'm in two minds. I was a little bit meh about the film. I like the little truthy bits, and I call them truthy because they're not necessarily factual. They're apocryphal, but they are probably what might have happened. And then why not use completely fictional people if that's what you're on about?
I mean, I think there's an element to which stuff can be thinly disguised, but they do change the names. I mean, I think if you park things to the side, you can say this is the story of Nelly. This is a fictional person and her fictional
story.
I'm
going to call her Clara Low.
An all-time low.
No, but you know, you understand. I agree with you, or I half agree with you, but you understand my point. If that's what you're on about, then why use somebody's actual life? And the reason that I say Clara Bow, just for our listeners as well, is that the crying on cue was famously a Clara Bow thing that she could do. The problem with the transition to sound and the microphones, it's part of Clara Bow's story. Her collaboration with Dorothy Arzner, her director, is part of Clara Bow's story. It's not something that you can sort of miss, right?
But it's hard to see where the movie comes from, right? Is it coming from the reference to Singing in the Rain that was mentioned, that why this story is told? For instance, about the introduction of sound into film, is it working towards that finale, the big reveal that actually then this all came up in a comedy version and Diego Calva is kind of insulted and saddened by the fact that this is now how Hollywood portrays those stories in the 50s? Or is it really based on the Hollywood mythology, including Clara Bow, that I'm not too familiar with, but I didn't quite know where the film was coming from in terms of its structure. But can I just say how much I suffered through that film? I mean, I was listening to, you know, your takes on it, which are super interesting. Also thinking of, you know, how much of that is based on the tabloid style of it and how much of it is a romantic film about Hollywood, contrasting with the others. But the first image of the film was actually one that I felt like throughout the film was that the elephant that they transport across. And at one point, the elephant just craps on top of one of the people who transports him. And I felt watching this film, I felt very much at the back of this elephant constantly.
Well, they kind of shoot it like it's happening to the camera. It happens to you when you're watching it.
And I think it happened to me then for the rest of the film. The level of exaggeration of the party, of the dancing, of the taking drugs, the level to which Nelly LeRoy was such an annoying character at times and went to such length of like pushing through and being this strong woman against the system. I thought this character could have never existed in 1920s Hollywood. She has the sensibility of, you know, let's make her into this 2022 heroine and kick the hell out of all these Hollywood bastards. It felt very misjudged to me as well as a portrayal of the time. And maybe that's where it comes in, where I felt these people didn't have a connection to in a golden age of Hollywood. Obviously, they're not Martin Scorsese. They're doing a really modern film about that, how that would feel like today. So I totally agree with you there, Alan, that it felt very modern to me, not in a good way. I felt kind of insulted by this, that a movie about that time can feel so much like it's a 2022 movie. And I didn't quite know what I don't think they knew what they were doing. And I felt overloaded by the visuals, by the exaggeration, by the excess that goes on through the film, and by these characters that I didn't care about. None of them were in any way approachable to me. Not even Brad Pitt going through the disintegration of his career.
The monologue. Oh, dear.
Oof. It was bad. Bad in the worst possible way. I don't know how to describe it. I suffered.
But I think it's interesting because I became aware of this film through my social media timeline. And people were just furious. They just hated it so much. And then I watched it for the first time. And I was like, well, it's sort of sophomoric. Let's start with the shit and piss and crap and fucking and cocaine. And I'm like, oh, golly, how old are you? Like 5? And then, of course, my annoyance, but I'm a complete geek and I do appreciate everybody is as much of a nerd as I am. But then the historical references sort of seem misplaced to me. I'm like, either you're going to go for this and you make this sort of, I don't know, American Pie type, half comedy, half satire, fine by me, but then leave Virginia Rappe and Fatty Arbuckle and poor Clara Bow out of it. Now, to be fair, Clara Bow had an unfortunate tendency of both being very promiscuous and also trying to tick off her powerful boyfriends by just claiming she had had sex with about 55 people she never even came close to just to make him angry. So she didn't really help her own history in that sense. But I'm like, do either one thing or the other. Make this sort of weird sophomoric, it was a terrible time, it was a wonderful time, and look what we got from it. Or try to respect the people, the historical people that you're talking about. You can't sort of have it both ways somehow.
I mean, I think you can in the sense that that fits into Hollywood mythologizing. I think, you know, it's Clara Bow with the serial number scraped off, but also bits of other stories. I think there are other starlets from the time that have been amalgamated into, like, for the cliche, that the dad as her business manager who is utterly hopeless. That feels like something from the time. The past that she's kind of escaping from, that felt very, you could find that with quite a few famous people would have had. I think they're sort of deliberately amalgamating people, which is why that they've scratched the names off and created new fictional ones.
But the things that you name now are part of Clara Bow's history. Her dad was an absolute unmentionable.
But so were many others. I think what the film is trying to do is have this amalgam of what would have been people at the time. And I think, you know, they scratch the name off and they say, oh, look, it's someone else. But everyone watching it is getting the impression, well, this is what it would have been like for stars at the time. But I don't think it was. I think it feels more modern in that. And again, it's kind of the repeating motif in this. When you have the party, they seem like fun, hedonistic celebration. But parties at the time would have been very rich men and very desperate sex workers. You wouldn't have had a really happy orgy where everyone from all races and creeds and colours are obviously having a great time. I don't buy that that was part of Hollywood. I don't think it existed back then. You know, there were people being promiscuous, but in the context of the big Hollywood parties, that actually reflected how powerful people with money would abuse their position. That's why they would be so huge. And I think it struggles to show that because it's so excited by the fact that it wants to say, hey, modern young people with your fun, promiscuous lives, that happened back then. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of, well, I don't think it did. And then I think if you engage with it as, oh, this relates to modern lives, then I think it is going into, and in your modern life, there is still oppression. There is still the way that the media can exploit people who think they're having fun. But that feels very Hollywood now. And I think the Tobey Maguire, the journey into the basements and the cellars.
Yeah.
That seems to reference, I don't know, the internet. Or that seems to reference the fact that pretty much if you want to see something now, you can see it. That if you go online, whatever disturbing imagery you want, you will find it somewhere. There is somewhere on the. It does not relate to the golden age of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. Even though there is a dark side to it, you're misrepresenting the dark side by painting it in this very, actually anything went. And anything didn't go. If you try to go beyond what the industry would accept, there was an acceptable level of decadent behavior. There was, you know, men could have all the women they wanted. But if you tried to do something that stepped out of that, you would not fit into Hollywood. It was a very sort of constraining debauchery, in a sense, that fits the time. And this just does not catch that. And then it's debauchery to then romanticize it. I feel very, you get to the end and you have this final montage when he's watching Singing in the Rain. And then you have this slightly surreal montage. Again, another parallel with Day of the Locust. There's an almost surreal montage at the end. But this montage is basically saying, isn't film brilliant?
Yeah.
And you go, well, like, what's your message then? Because Day of the Locust, it was very clear that this Hollywood is awful. This is horrible. Look at this horrible imagery, that surreal imagery that's going to take over. Whereas if you romanticize it, and yeah, it's interesting that he goes to see Singing in the Rain and he's seeing this 50s Hollywood version of what he lived through. But the final shot of the film is him smiling.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of think, well, is your message, all of that was okay because we get Singing in the Rain. And, and as someone who absolutely loves Singing in the Rain, that's not true. It was not okay.
No.
Or 2001, or all the films, this sort of bizarre journey to the future. And I don't understand the point.
No, it doesn't have one.
Same here. The tone was off for me. I didn't gauge what this film was trying to do. Also with the level of satire or comedy, there's this one scene, obviously, when they're trying out the sound. And then there's this scene where Margot Robbie has to walk in with her suitcase. And this is done. I mean, they're beating the horse to death in that scene. And I didn't know what they were doing. Was this supposed to be kind of Singing in the Rain satire? Because there is that scene in Singing in the Rain as well. And it wasn't funny. It was excruciating to watch that over and over. And it was also bad, terrible in terms of filmmaking. Why do you have to show that 15 times and then at the end for the guy to, you know, drop dead?
Yeah.
I mean, was that the shock value of the scene, showing how horrible the system was, like, aka Day of the Locust? Or was it supposed to be satirical, to be funny and like, oh my God, I have to do it again? Ha ha ha.
And again, you hit the nail right on the head there, Sam. Part of this is historical. Part of this happened. And I'm like, okay, you either go one way, you're like, this happened and it was kind of nuts, or you go the other way and a guy drops dead from heat exhaustion. You can't...
Kind of in both ways.
Right, you can't have it both ways. I feel the same way about, Alan, you alluded to this. Hollywood parties, in as much as I know during the time, and obviously I'm not a historian, I don't know everything, but a lot of them were in hotel lounges or in hotels, right? So the Fatty Arbuckle, Virginia Overpay thing, famously, took place in a hotel, not because they were sleeping around in hotels, but a lot of parties were in hotels because you could sleep over. So these whole epic festivals... Like you, I kind of have my doubts. They were mostly in either nightclubs or in hotels or, well, a lot of hotels, basically. And there was a lot of sleeping around and there was a lot, and I mean oceans, of alcohol, also cocaine, but mostly lots of alcohol. So again, I'm like, if you want to portray this wasn't Hollywood grand point, which I don't think we come away from the film with that point particularly. But then, okay, go for the historical. Go for, you know, Ivan Novello meeting J.W. Griffith in a hotel bar and him swooning over the man's profile or something. And if you're going to go for the transition to sound, then we should have a relationship between Arzner, so the director, and Clara Bow, so our Nelly, who, and the Brooklyn accent, who tries to sort of guide her through this process. You can't do it half and half or both, or I don't know. It's both too much of everything and too little.
And I think following on from what Sam said about the scene where they're trying, you know, she's trying to catch the mark and they're trying to get the sound correct, is actually what really struck me is, for what's meant to be a film about film, it's incredibly episodic in the point that they have set piece. And the set piece runs for about half an hour. Like the party runs for, at the beginning, runs for half an hour. It's like the set piece. Then that ends, and then we move on to the next one. And probably a little bit similar to The Aviator, but The Aviator is a better director. He can storytell better. He could link things better. This really felt episodic. Now we have this bit of the story, which is going to be an extended episode about them recording a scene. And now we're going to have this bit. And that really felt like it's missing. Was this meant to be a TV series or something originally? Because
disjointed.
Yeah, disjointed is the perfect word. And another thing that I found really disappointing is the fact that, which again felt very modern. So you have the story about the black musician, the sort of trumpeter, who then gets to a level of fame, and then they say, oh, you're not black enough, you have to do blackface for this take. And he goes, well, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to wander off and have a happy life playing in jazz clubs. And it felt like the most contrived happy ending. When again, if you go back to the industry and America, it was so racist you wouldn't have had that happy ending. The situation would have been that if he wanted to still have money to survive, he would have done that. And he would have had to keep doing that. And he would have had to accept that. And that is a horrible story. And it's the film goes, well, we don't want to do the horrible bit. We'll shift into this. Okay, he's not as rich as he was, but he's got a happy ending.
Perfect example, actually, yeah.
And it reminded me, there was the TV series Hollywood, the Ryan Murphy thing, that I think its deliberate point from the outset was, oh, I want to imagine a Hollywood that gets things right, that doesn't do the terrible things it did do. And you sort of watch it, and it starts off as an slightly intriguing what if, but at some point you go, this is horrible. This is doing such a disservice to people who really suffered, to kind of pretend that if the system had been a little bit nicer, everything would have been fine. And there is something like really uncomfortable. And that moment, again, I think with Ryan Murphy, they're romanticizing it so much. And almost the pendulum has swung the other way from Day of the Locust. They've gone, Day of the Locust, I think, is too bitter. It won't engage in what's fun in it. Which makes me think of these are people who were industry professionals who remembered the heyday and they lived it. They thought it was just a job. There is no romance here. And they made this incredibly bitter, angry film. But now we've got a subsequent generation who had no actual living experience of the time. And they've romanticized it. And they've included the tabloids. They've included all the nasty stories. But they've put it all together and go, well, this is all fun about the greatness that is cinema, which you've got the final montage, which is, oh, isn't cinema amazing? And that is a flawed position. That is a fundamentally flawed position, to romanticize this stuff as if it's okay and that it gave characters happy endings and that there's almost a sort of slightly ugly romancing of suicide. The sense that the two sort of Brad Pitt character and Margot Robbie character, I think their deaths are within the narrative of romanticized excess. Oh, they lived the most amazing life. And when that ended, they couldn't carry on. So one's a drug overdose, one's a suicide. And I'm really uncomfortable with that. That feels like a cop-out. And it tells it in a romantic way. It kind of makes us want to think, well, it makes sense for Brad Pitt to be doing what he does, because he has reached a natural storytelling end. The best bits happened. We're at the end. Well, there's nothing else for him to do. And then Margot Robbie dancing into the night as the, like, I'm going to embrace the success. I'm not going to run off. I love this party life, even though it will destroy me. I will dance into it, and then we'll read a headline that she died. And these are narratives that romanticizing it, I'm really uncomfortable with. But again, that feels quite a 2022 thing, that we started doing this. We started treating it this way, like the story of rock legends that commit suicide gets romanticized. So again, you would never have had this. I don't think even in the 20s and 30s they would have sold this narrative. It's a very 2022 narrative. And ultimately, I think possibly it's about the 2022 film industry. And if it is, it's not nasty enough about the 2022 film.
Can I just end with one positive thing about the film?
Sure, please.
It is, the one good thing about the film is the Anna May Wong, that's the historical character she portrays, the actress, and Marlene Dietrich mashup song number. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
With the top hat, the lady with the top hat singing. Now that, I'm sorry, but that made me applaud the screen, because one, Anna May Wong was a badass woman and a badass actress. So was Marlena, You mash them up, you have instant greatness. I was floored. I love that bit. And there are tiny little moments within Babylon that are like that, that actually sort of almost inadvertently grab hold of something that actually is quite fabulous. And then they let it go and forget it and never mention it again, which is sad.
I think I have another issue that goes back to the Ryan Murphy Hollywood with that, in the sense that the sort of Anna May Wong character has... She's still not a person because she's so great. True. So there's no inner life about the real person who had to fight or struggle. She is just awesome. And then silly people do things and she's the sort of token character that rolls their eyes and sorts things out. And, you know, again, it's swinging the pendulum too far the other way rather than sort of like, well, there was a person there. The person wasn't flawless. The person wasn't two-dimensional. But you've made this two-dimensional perfect character. Do you not realize that you're still playing in the same world of simplistic stereotypes?
True, but I just don't mind Anna May Wong being a complete bisexual badass that much.
The choice of song was great, you know?
And the image is really striking. It goes back to, like, I agree that that is an incredible thing. That sort of suckers me in. If they said we've made a film with this thinly disguised Anna May Wong being badass for 90 minutes and solving crime, I would watch
yes,
that film.
I'm sold.
I would be there. I would. But including her as sort of a bit part in this film, it has that sort of tokenistic, two-dimensional thing, which really sunk the Hollywood, Ryan Murphy's Hollywood. It comes back to what you both said. It doesn't really know what it's doing. And it chucks these feel-good moments in. And then you go, but what am I meant to be feeling good about?
And sorry to be the elephant in the room again who does his thing on this scene. I do feel that there's also a certain difference with regards to the musical performances in the films, because all of them have these grand moments where the jazz band or the singer performs. And I feel Babylon did it worst of them all. Not because, in a way, I feel the Anna May Wong song that she sings is supposed to, in this scene, make us giddily snicker at, you know, what kind of risque lyrics they were using in the... And it's not funny at all.
No, no.
I mean, it might be... It's almost as if we're giggling again at the fact that at the time you could use the P word here for a funny lyric and we're supposed to think, oh, you know, the great old times. And I felt that I didn't like the scene at all. But I guess if you think of that character and of the reality behind it, you have a different background. I just felt it was really badly done in terms of the performance or how they put together the musical performance, where you have this voodoo scene in Day of the Locust, which is just properly cabaret and weird, and it fits the film. Or the aviator jazz scenes, which are great.
Yeah, they are great. Okay, I'm going to have to, because we're out of time again. I don't know how that happens.
How do we do that?
Every time. I just want to ask a more sort of broad question, right? If you talk about Hollywood history and you talk about portraying that in a movie that's supposed to be fun and engaging, because of course all the famous directors listen to our podcasts, Alan and Sam's, just so you know.
Oh God.
Marty tunes in every single month.
Damien Chazelle hopefully doesn't.
No, I hope not. What would you like to see? What would your ideal Hollywood history lore mashup kind of look like? Maybe you have a director in mind. Go for it. Sam, you go first because you look the most pensive.
Yeah, I'm pensive because I really struggle to come up with something on the spot. I do think maybe I'm a bit of a conservative there. I would probably prefer the straight biopic approach to more personalities from Hollywood, because I think I'm really interested in not the myth and then debunking that myth and finding out what Hollywood was like. So I'd like to have more of these straightforward biopics of some of the characters that come up, also some of the, you know, the politicians, the lawyers, the people in the background, maybe someone who's really a little bit like in Babylon, the character of Manny Torres in Babylon. I felt that was an interesting approach. People who work in the background of the big stars and kind of put those strings together for them. But in terms of director, yeah, I'm not going to go out on a limb and wish for some. Maybe Marty is going to do another one in that same vein.
So.
Who knows? I'd be open.
I mean, I fear I'm too steeped in the legend that I would start thinking, who had a fascinating story? Let's tell that story. Rather than necessary that it will work as a film, or it needs to be told as a film. So I guess my cop-out answer is I'd almost want someone who has no romantic attachment to the period and probably isn't even American to just say, here's the material. Do you think there's a story here? And what would be the story that you tells about this society? Because I think I am too biased towards the legend. I am fascinated by the, in quotation mark, heroes that have emerged, the troubled geniuses, the great men, again in inverted commas, that emerged from this period of time. I'm too steeped in that. And I think even if you go the other way and say, well, I'm going to make a film that's going to destroy them, you are still playing this game of mythologizing them, putting them in the center. And I think I would want someone who had, you know, someone young who didn't know any of it and just said, is there anything in this that interests you? Tell that story, because that would be something new.
Now, me, I'm sort of a little bit on Sam's side here. What I would like is an actual Hollywood on Hollywood movie about the teens in the 20s, so a little bit earlier, because that's the fascinating period in Hollywood history, which is very underserved everywhere. And then have a nice director. How about having Denis Villeneuve on board and making a movie about Frances Marion and Mary Pickford or something in that period of Hollywood when women still had a say in Hollywood? That is what I would like.
I mean, I would definitely see it. I would watch it. I would go
see
it.
Sounds lovely. Let's see it.
Okay, any final thoughts, guys?
Well, just another recommendation. I think I wanted to watch Sunset Boulevard, and I wish I had, even though it was fun talking about Day of the Locust. It was a fascinating take, but I think there were a couple of movies that we missed out on that could have been worthwhile talking about that are actually very good movies.
I mean, I would put Singing in the Rain in. I adore it as a film. Sunset Bullet, Singing in the Rain. I think one more, and we've got a probably more positive podcast.
Yeah, sequel. Let's do a sequel.
Absolutely. Well, with that, thank you so much to our listeners. Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Alan. And we very much hope to see you next time on A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.